what is actually the real world experience of real people? And in kind of historically, we have ignored that data set because it is too messy.
Thomas Getz made his way from social science to healthcare via journalism. Even while executive editor at Wired magazine, he was thinking about the role technology can play to remedy the trial and error methods we've so long lived with in the field. Now as CEO of Iodine, Thomas is giving voice to patients and combining their input with science to bridge the analog divide with digital solutions.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
So we're joined today by one of our very, very favorite people. This is sort of like a meeting of the Thomas Getz fan club. Former editor of Wired, author one of our favorite books, Remedy, founder of the healthcare startup Iodine. We're just so excited to have you on our program today, Thomas.
Well, it's a thrill to be joining you. I'm a fan of the podcast.
Excellent. And I know there's so many things that we can talk to you about, but I want to jump right in to the Remedy and something you wrote in there, because I think it's a nice jumping off point to so many of the things you've done, at least on the healthcare side, since you left Wired. And you wrote in there in this book, if you haven't read it, people in the audience, it's an incredible book, The Remedy. You can find it on Amazon. And it's about, in the broad sense of the word, it's about data and clinical trials and how easy it is for doctors to get swayed to change evidence to make their point and how dangerous that is. And I, you know, there was a part in there where you wrote about Arthur Conan Doyle, who's kind of the guy that discovers that the cure for TB that's been put out there is a fraud. And Arthur Conan Doyle, of course, is the guy that wrote Sherlock Holmes. And so it's a very, you know, interesting tale. And Conan Doyle writes, and you quote, "Someone described our condition, that of the physician, as that of a blind man with a club who swung it at random. Sometimes he hit the disease and sometimes the patient." And I think that's such a great quote. And I, you know, especially considering what you're doing now with Iodine, you know, why did you choose that? What does that mean to you? And how does that manifest itself today?
Wow. Well, I'm glad you found that quote, because I'd forgotten about it. It is a lovely one. So the Remedy, you know, it's kind of this, it was for me, I'm a long time, kind of medical history geek. And so it was to me a great story of, really the birth of modern medicine as told through the experience of Robert Koch, who was one of the great heroes of the germ theory, but also, like many heroes, has a kind of tragic flaw in that he was incredibly ambitious and overreached in his work on tuberculosis. And I think that is one of the challenges of medicine that we still face today, is really how much do we know about what medicine can and cannot tell us? You know, how much uncertainty is there still in medicine and the care we provide? And it's something we grapple with every day at Iodine, and I think has really become the focus of our work, is trying to help people understand which medications work for them through the experience of other people, and understanding that, you know, when you leave the doctor's office with a prescription, there is a high probability, in some case, a high likelihood that that medication is not going to work for you, is going to fail. And so helping people kind of go through that process, which is right now, you know, really still managed the way Arthur Conan Doyle described, as a very manual process of the physician trying to grope his way. And what we're trying to do is to bring software and algorithms to the process so that we can use the data that exists in people's experience in their everyday lives and use that to guide people towards a better probability of outcome. That's all very broad, but that's kind of what we're doing.
So like Conan Doyle, you committed yourself to medicine, but you're really a writer, right? You're known by many people for being a writer. And so how did you get from the Wall Street Journal, Industry Standard, Wired, of all things, to where you are now? How did you make that transition to dedicate yourself to healthcare?
I come from a family of healthcare practitioners. So my father was a doctor, my mother was a nurse, my sister is a surgeon.
More than a doctor, I mean, your father was a very prominent academic diabetologist.
Yeah, no, he was a real
legendary.
He was an inspiring. It's funny, I didn't really understand how much of a figure he was in the diabetes research field until I entered the healthcare world myself. You know, growing up, he was just a great dad. But really, it was, you know, I was encouraged to do anything I wanted to do, and that for Really, that was writing and journalism. And but I also had my other sister, Cecilia, was a public health worker. And actually, in the late 90s, 1998, she was killed in Uganda when she was doing public health work. And that made me...
That's terrible.
Yeah, I know, and it's a story unto itself. But her work, in many ways, I always felt was kind of unfinished. She was wonderful and just coming into her own as a public health researcher. And
she was working with the Minnesota International Health
exactly,
Volunteers,
exactly.
Right?
So, you know, I'm not doing global health, but in many ways, after Cece died, I even though I was still pursuing, you know, my career as a journalist, I had the opportunity to go over on mornings and go to Berkeley, and I got my master's of public health. And that really inspired me.
Go Bears.
Yeah. Well, it was a wonderful, it was great. I loved going to Berkeley, even though I was this, you know, relatively old man among youngsters. But it was, it led me, so then I started to think, okay, I have this world of wired and information technology and all this kind of cultural change that's being born by technology, but why is that not hitting public health? Why is that not hitting medicine and healthcare? And, you know, I think traditionally medicine, the way technology has kind of come into medicine is through biotechnology, like drugs or devices, or kind of these kind of scanning technologies, none of which kind of leverage what information technology is good at, which is scale and reduce cost and increase efficiency. And so out of that, I wrote that book, my first book, The Decision Tree, which really tried to gesture towards the opportunity to bring information technology to healthcare via the patient, via the individual who has the capacity, I believe, to make better actions based on better information. And so that book did pretty well, and I think it was well-timed in the sense that it articulated a vision for the future of medicine and healthcare that really we've seen in the last 5 years has come to flourish. And eventually, just to kind of put a bow on the story, eventually I was more interested in participating in that world than chronicling it at Wired.
So do you really think it's come to flourish yet, or do you think it's come to come to just sort of barely scratching the surface? I mean, to me, I look at all that's going on with data and analytics and algorithms and, you know, yada, yada. And I think
some of us do that for a living.
I know. Yeah. I mean, including
yada,
me.
Yada.
I just think, you know, has it really done much yet? Or is it just sort of cool toys?
Oh,
at the
absolutely.
Moment?
No, I mean, there's a long way to go, but I think, you know.
You wanted to say boys with toys, didn't you?
Would have been accurate.
But you guys would admit that, you know, compared to where this was 5 years ago, you know, there were a handful of companies, 23andMe, Patients Like Me, a couple others, that were talking about this world. But the healthcare world was not necessarily listening at all. And now I have the sense from both bottom up and top down reasons, the ACA being a big driver of change, there is a palpable sense of this is happening. We have to be part of it. The change is afoot. And that's what we're trying to participate in Iodine. That's what we're trying to help create at Iodine.
Hey, we appreciated that the change is afoot line, by the way, in the reference to Conan Doyle, by the way.
it's always in the back
exactly.
of my mind.
So I'm curious, what was, when you were at Wired, to backtrack a little bit, what was your favorite story or thing you ever wrote?
So I was an editor. So I helped, you know, run the magazine and my
right.
kind of, my greatest pleasure was deciding what was on the cover every month. And that was mm-hmm. kind of a great responsibility, but also, just a lot of fun. Cause you could, you know, the idea was to always say something ambitious and audacious and with an expectation that we would be wrong one third of the time. And that is a great liberty and license as a kind of creative, person who's thinking about how the world is changing. So that was just awesome.
So what was the best one? What was the biggest, you know, wrong that you printed on the cover? What was the one that really blew up on you?
Oh, well, what did we get most wrong? Well, before my tenure, there were, you know, they put, you know, smell technology was something they put on the cover. There were a couple other doozies. And actually, one of the second issue of Wired, if you will, had a big article about the future of medicine driven by informatics and data. And that was 1993. And, you know, you can go 20 years after that and that vision that it had still hadn't come true. So that was, in some sense, a myth.
My guess is that there's some possibility they could print that cover today and it would still be 20 years before the true evidence-based, you know, outcomes will have come.
Well, so you just had so much of a chance to appreciate both sort of the techno-utopians, you might call it, or the people, the power of technology through the work Lisa was just describing that you sort of oversaw and, you know, were immersed in it at Wired. What is your sense of what technologists, of the technologist's view of medicine versus what you always seem to me to bring sort of far more depth than what I would say would be a typical technologist, where you, I mean, you're immersed in technology, but you're such a humanist at heart. And, you know, I really see you as such like a people first person who understands with far more sophistication than almost anyone I know all of the power of technology, but you really appreciate at the end of the day, it's about the people. How does that contrast or with what you're seeing about some of the technologists who are trying very earnestly, when you see people like, I don't know if he's one of your investors, but you probably can't talk about him, like Chamath or some of these other folks who sort of have, okay, well, why don't we just get a bunch of smart engineers and solve the problems?
Yeah, well, I think that is that's a kind of classic technologist approach, is, you know, identify the problem and route around it, or make it, you know, bring such efficiencies to bear that it is fixed or eliminated. And there, don't get me wrong, there are massive inefficiencies, as you both well know. I mean, healthcare is awash in inefficiency. And so there is a lot to be optimized, a lot that technology, even in a superficial sense, can optimize and improve upon. So I think that's not misguided. I think that approach is not misguided, but I don't think it necessarily cuts to the root of the goals, the deeper set goals of healthcare, which is to improve the quality of people's lives and to improve how we deal with disease as a culture and as a kind of industry. So so I think in some sense there's a kind of low first order of solutions that technology can fix. You know, in some sense the EHR was an effort to do some of those for good and largely bad. But I think what's more interesting, you know, I think ultimately these come down to issues of complexity, and I think the kind of classic technological approach is we will, in routing around the problem, we will eliminate complexity. I think what you're finding, and you're finding in this kind of the current wave of kind of startups and technologies that are coming to healthcare, is that you can't get around some of these complexities, right? You can't route around the problem.
Well, in fact, I think it's a way to, I think it's the opposite potentially, is that we can now embrace complexity because we can parse it more.
Right, exactly. That's an important part of it, is that technological approach it does work, right? I mean, if you can parse complexity, that's a great start. And I think traditionally healthcare has been like, oh, it's so complicated. Healthcare is different, right? There was always this kind of healthcare exceptionalism, mostly from inside healthcare, that the rules of the rest of the world don't apply to healthcare. And I don't think that's true. I think what we're learning is healthcare is not different. I think what we are learning is healthcare is infinitely complex, and it is slower because of that. So it's not different, but it is slower. It is harder.
Well, I think it has a piece of subjectivity to it that so many other fields do not, right? Because so much is unknown about, you know, the or expected or anticipated, but not really known about how human behavior impacts things.
And I think there are a lot of gaps between sort of, I think a lot of technologists sort of approach it as, oh, you come in for a diagnosis, here's your diagnosis, here's your treatment. And it's just sort of very discrete sort of problem solving. And I mean, I remember like the number one thing I think maybe I appreciated during my, I guess like when, so I did, you know, this joint training where you sort of do a couple of years of medicine, go back, you know, do a PhD, come back and do your clinical medicine. And my expectation had been that clinical medicine was going to be like applied science. And it just wasn't anything like that. I mean, this was, now is just this incredible revelation, how it was empiricism, it was scientism, where people would sort of embrace a scientific explanation more or less as a way of memorizing something. But what you'd actually do for most people was not so much based on some, oh, basic science insight, but based on what people have figured out by, you know, trying a bunch of different things. So it was really empirical, but it was then wrapped in this sort of, you know, they're wrapped in science or sort of this scientism. And so in your company, how do you try to blend? Tell us what you're doing at Aya, because you're doing so much exciting stuff you're working with. I know you're working with the FDA. You have a new initiative. How are you trying to blend your this sort of science and data and analytics with your sense of what is it that people really want from a healthcare company,
right.
Say?
Well, so the basic problem that we're trying to grapple with is what works for which people? What treatments, mostly starting with medications, but eventually, you know, in our grand vision, we will be able to have all treatments from therapies to surgeries, whatever might be as part of the algorithm. But right now we're looking at what medications are most effective for which people and how do we guide people to those. And I think the to pick up on what you're saying, the data set that we're really excited about is people's subjective experience. So we, you know, there's kind of the data set on which we make therapeutic decisions is largely based on two sets of data. It's the trial data, the randomized controlled trials that the FDA requires in order to approve medications. And that happens before a drug is in the wild. And then there's the kind of heuristic empirical data of the physician. But those two data sets are both imperfect. The one is, you know, overly controlled and overly artificial in some sense, the RCT world. And the second is not mapped enough. But then there's this whole other, in some sense, potentially better data set, which is what is actually the real world experience of real people. And in kind of historically, we have ignored that data set because it is too messy, right? It is too multifaceted. It's too complicated to actually measure. And what we're trying to do at Iodine is to measure that. And out of that measurement to gain some insight that will optimize the problem. So specifically, we're looking at right now, we started with a broad set of drugs and on our website, iodine.com, where you can get a kind of good basic data and experiential data, but also looking at FDA data for what happens in the real world with drugs. But out of that website is flourishing. And out of those users, we've learned that there's this more deeper problem, which is when somebody starts a therapy, they want to know what to expect. They want to know what mm-hmm. am I in for? Mm-hmm. And then they want to know oftentimes, okay, this isn't working for me. What should I switch to? And so out of that, we've developed this new product that we're extremely excited about. And we really think is the future of the company, which is an app called Start. And it's built for people who are starting an antidepressant and depression, the treatment of depression.
Wow, so that's very specific
exactly.
use case.
Because we're looking at depression because there was actually a JAMA report last week. 13% of Americans are taking an antidepressant. And
yeah, and about 50% of those antidepressants don't work for people.
And that 50% figure is from RCTs. It's not from real world. If you actually look at the real world, it's right. more like 30%.
It's probably worse.
So you've got this huge...
Right. But then, and there's this famous study, right? There's essentially this Dodo verdict where everyone has won and all deserve prizes, right? How everybody is antidepressant works at about this, like they all work in about the same percentage of people. And
they're all lousy, but they're all equally
yeah.
lousy.
Well, I mean, they work for some people, but yeah, I mean, you know.
It's random. Or it appears random at the moment,
yes.
right? How you know which one works for who, and it takes you, you know, maybe 4 weeks to even know if it's doing anything or not for you, and it's really quite a trial and
right.
error.
So this is a great, this is a perfect opportunity where yeah. you're saying, okay, here's an area where people think in general medicines, I mean, there's some cynics who say, oh, it's all placebo, but then I think there are many who go, look, it probably, that there is some opportunity for benefit here, but how do you match up the right patient with the right medicine proactively?
Right, and so it's all about... it's really about capturing what happens when they leave the doctor's office and providing the follow-up, really turning the follow-up into the algorithm. So we're really trying to improve things on two levels. One, help that person stay adherent and work through. And basically what we did is we took clinical guidelines and turned them into this program. So we help people report how they're doing on the medication. And we give them progress reports in return that are these kind of very elegant, nice visualized data sets based on what they've been telling us. And out of that, they can understand, okay, this is working for me at a certain point at 6 weeks, or it's not working for me, in which case they need to be switching to a different medication. And so we're optimizing.
And are you also taking into account the side effects profile? Because
yeah.
it may be working for them on their depression, but maybe really bothering them in some
exactly.
other way.
Exactly. So that's the important thing is we're measuring both kind of there's a kind of clinical benchmark, which is the PHQ-9 survey, But there's also this mm-hmm. kind of, which is, I mean, but there's also all this kind of experiential effect, the kind of messiness of issues and side effects. And are you making progress on your goals? Are you spending time with your family? And so we ask people both of those things, right? So it's both the clinical measure and the kind of real life measure. And the reason we started with depression is because it's symptomatic, because the your experience is in many ways the clinical experience, so, or the clinical measure.
Right.
So we're trying to create that feedback loop between the person's experience and the medication, so that they can understand either, yes, this medication is working for me, or no, it's not. I need to go back to my doctor and try something else. And we're trying to, so improving outcomes in some sense, improving the intervention, because you're guiding people through the side effects, but also shortening the time period of trial and error. So
do you have to have somebody start your car for you in case the pharmaceutical companies are trying to kill you? Because I mean, this is their bread and butter, selling these products. And if you can demonstrate that, you know, they don't work for a large number of people for whom they're being prescribed, they got to be really
So I would have a different view. My guess is that I think that people would much rather figure, I mean, I think everyone's frustrated by the fact that it's such a black box. And if you're able to really kind of annotate the space and be able to say, wait a minute, this is the kind of person who, or these are the features of somebody, or this is what's really bothering somebody, and this particular type of antidepressant works for this type, you're able to, in a sense, either subcategorize depression or subcategorize the types of people or the characteristics of people, so you can more precisely match people. I mean, so many antidepressants are generic now,
exactly.
Are going to be generic pretty soon. I think that it seems, so how does this relate to something like Ginger.io, where they're trying to sort of use your smartphone to kind of be able to, plus doing a depression test, a depression scale. Would this in theory be synergistic with that, or is it just sort of orthogonal?
Well, so I think what they're doing is wonderful. We're also collecting accelerometer data, so it's kind of a data set that we're looking at. I think what's different is we are really trying to connect that, create that feedback loop with the medication. So for us, we're not saying that the app is the therapy. We're saying that the app is an essential part of knowing if the therapy is working. So really, it's the software. Our start app is the software that goes along with the commoditized hardware, which is the pill. We are at a point in medicine where it's crazy that we should be prescribing medications with the software that helps people understand, are they working? And that is really what we're creating. And out of that, we're able to, we don't have this yet. It's only been out for 2 months, 2.5 months. But we are really excited about the opportunity to start to do some predictive modeling and understand, okay, based on what dose you're on, based on what you're onboarding and what kind of issues you're identifying, there is a high likelihood that you're going to drop out. And so we can go back to the doctor and we say, look, these are the patients that you need to be mindful of, because they're probably going to have a high likelihood of having to switch medications. So at 6 weeks, you're going to want to have them back in the office.
At the high level, one of the things that you're talking about, which I think is the absolute challenge of disease management, is how to de-average a population.
Yeah.
Whether you call it personalized or precision or whatever it is, it's basically the idea that that a population of people that have one trait are actually many different subpopulations respond differently, and that if you're able to sort of figure out how to do that, and ideally proactively, you can, in theory, treat folks better. And it sounds like that's a big picture about what you're trying to do. And then I guess the question is, some people want to engage with apps, but there's a lot of when you're speaking about a de-averaging a population, there's a large number of people who really don't, who don't want to be that involved, who want to be, give me a medicine and let me feel better. How do you, are you encountering that? Do you think that making people constantly ask if their medicine is or isn't working, are there some people for whom that would impact, for positive or for negative, the efficacy of it? There are people who just say, give me the medicine, and then I want to assume that I'm better? Or how do you deal with that?
Well, so, there is no such thing as an intervention in medicine that works for everybody. Even Imodium doesn't work for everybody, even though it turns out to be very effective for most people. So apps are, you think about apps as an intervention, they have they have a hit rate on some level that some people are going to be more likely to use them than not. But that said, I think what we're really trying to do is to understand, okay, this person is starting a course of treatment that is typically highly ambiguous and opaque and very inefficient in terms of making some kind of decision that goes back to the doctor. And if we can work with the patient, give them something useful and beneficial to them in the kind of day-to-day, which is peer support and a sense of context and a sense of progress, then at these two-week intervals, we can start to assemble a body of insights about that experience so that they can either get past that those kind of side effects, that early onboarding with a drug, or they can make that assessment that, you know, this isn't working for me. I got to go back to my doctor.
Now, it looks like you have this targeted towards the consumer, towards the patient. Is there an aspect of this where the report that you're producing won't just sort of be sort of like, you know, a PDF, but will be something that could be incorporated directly into a patient's EMR, something like that?
Yeah, well, so that integration, you know, I'm at the Medical Informatics Association conference, and we are talking just about that very thing, because we do know that the power of this is not just for the patient, but for the system. And so we think it creates value for the pharmacy, because it improves refills and improves adherence, and it improves people's experience. We think it improves the physician's opportunity, because it's creating that feedback loop, the follow-up that, you know, they exactly. should be doing, but they're not. So we're very excited about the opportunity to connect it back to the physician. You know, we're doing this in a kind of scrappy startup way, which is to say we built it, put it out for consumers, and we are really trying to create something that works for consumers first and then build it into whatever integrations make it more powerful.
I'm just sitting here thinking how ironic it is that we're going to use and that we are using apps to improve medical compliance when people aren't compliant with the apps, much less the meds, you know, and like, is that just going down a rabbit hole? I mean, are we going to come out the other side and, you know, Alice is going to be laughing at us? I mean, is it a compounding problem?
I get a little bit annoyed when people talk about, not at you, but I get annoyed when people start saying, oh, apps, people.
You can be annoyed at Lisa.
People don't use apps.
You want to be the first guy.
I can poke her for you. Poke.
Look, any medication has high drop-off. Any intervention has high drop-off, right? So that is the way of the world. Right. Not everything works for everybody.
Right.
And that's really, I mean, going back to what David was saying, what we're trying to understand is what works best for which people. So we are using our best design know-how and our best UX experts. I'm privileged to work with a really good UX designer, like world class, who is helping us create something that actually does respond to a wide population of people's needs. But I think it's unfair to say that apps have to work for all people, because frankly, that isn't the standard that we have for other medical interventions.
You're right, but it's so interesting. But you think away about how these things are purchased by like payers and stuff, or health systems, and they do an RFP process, and they have seven companies pitch, and then they pick one that they're going to use as their universal platform, and that's probably the absolute wrong way to go about it. You probably need three different platforms because they appeal to three different kinds of people.
Yeah, just as we have formularies, like, right? We have formularies that we're optimizing.
Yeah. I mean, what you're describing is very much what the guy from Jeff always talks about.
Right, Derek,
of what they're trying to do. But as long as we're sort of name-dropping interesting companies, some of what your approach is doing also reminds me of a talk we had a couple of months ago with Linda Avey of We Are Curious, where she really is trying to... Everyone loves Linda. There's a lot that's exciting about what she's doing to capture the voice of the patient. Do you see similarities in what you're trying to do on the sort of response to medication side, similar to what she's trying to do on the understanding of sort of the original condition itself side, or are there fundamental distinctions that would be important to be aware of?
Well, I mean, I am not. I think Linda has always been kind of ahead of the curve on thinking about what personal data can start to drive better decisions and better improving the system. For us, I think we're very focused on, you know, these patient reported experiences, patient reported outcomes. We think it's the real kind of keys to the kingdom in terms of optimizing. I mean, I know, David, you talked a lot about, and you're working day-to-day on precision medicine from a genetic point of view, but the line I say is, in some sense, we need more microscopes or I'm sorry, fewer microscopes and more microphones. We need microphones to ask people's opinions, because that can be, in some sense, as significant and kind of data point as your genome or your proteome or your microbiome.
So in terms of the patient report outcome, I mean, there's actually a whole to get patient report outcomes. So that has both like an informal meeting in terms of the digital health press, but also has a very, as you obviously are aware, but more for the audience, the concept of patient reported outcomes also has specific meaning in the context of the mm-hmm. FDA, what they use for pharmaceuticals. And there's a very specific process that a patient-reported outcome measure has to go through. So on the one hand, the FDA has these efforts underway to try to stimulate the production of more of those, because they realize that the patient experience isn't adequately captured. But it's also really hard to try to have PROs that are robust enough. Is your idea that what you're working on would eventually be sort of formalized enough that it would be sort of incorporated into an endpoint that the FDA would recognize?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with that's why we're starting with symptomatic conditions. So depression has the PHQ-9, which is a validated self-reported measure of outcomes. We're also looking at pain as another symptomatic area that has 50 million Americans are on pain medications. There are self-reported benchmarks. So we look at PROs from the FDA side. We also are very interested in the quality measures that are coming into play from CMS, and those quality measures correlate to patient experience and patient outcomes. So there is, and this is where I'm talking about that kind of the top-down shifts. It's amazingly powerful, and something that we're really happy to be kind of on the forefront of is being in a place to instrument and capture these patient measures, because they are starting to become the things by which insurance companies are measured, as well as the drugs themselves.
So as we're reaching the end of our time here, Thomas, it's so good to talk to you. And I have a question, which is, if you were now the editor of Wired,
you were picking the cover,
for the next issue with the plan to look back 10 years from now and decide if it was right or wrong. What's the cover say? What's the cover story today?
Health related cover story, right?
Yeah, and it can't be iodine. Can't be iodine, the company of the future.
It can be.
Well, iodine was on the last cover. Let's just assume that.
Okay, that's fair. I think.
And DNA Nexus is on the next one. So yeah.
I mean, here's, and I'm gonna pick it up, and it's a little self serving, but I'm gonna pick up something from my friend Sean Duffy at Omada. What I think is so powerful right now is the power of information technology to bridge what Sean described to me as the analog divide. So the digital divide we've all heard about, and it's the kind of access to the internet and access to technology, which is over the years dissipating and going down thanks to smartphones. But what is kind of entrenched in the system is this analog divide, which is access to resources, access to humans. It's in very much the manual analog part of the problem of distributing access to healthcare. And that's what I think, that's what's so cool about what Omada is doing. That's what I hope, I believe we're doing at Iodine, is bridging that analog divide with algorithms and software that takes best practices, what should be happening in that ideal world that we talked about, and actually starts to make it happen. So we're just to loop back to that Conan Doyle thing. So we're smashing the patient a little less, and actually giving them the things that they need. How's that?
Great.
It's fantastic.
That's... There you go. Nice wrap. And that's a wrap. Thank you so much, Thomas. We've just really enjoyed having you on.
Absolutely. Always inspiring and elevating. Thank you so much for joining us, Thomas.
This was a delight.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Wow. He is so articulate.
Yeah. And he's so interesting. And I think that, one of the great advantages of social scientists being in medicine is they come with such a different perspective.
Well, I think the idea of crossing the analog divide is an incredibly important concept, and I'm so excited to see where his company goes. Anyway, this is another episode of Tectonics. You can follow Lisa and me on Twitter, Lisa on her blog Venture Valkyrie, and me contributing in Forbes.
Over and out.